Okay, well, let's try and get started. Will Johnson is going to give us our last paper on From Ontology to Taxonomy, the Jaina Colonization of the Universe.
Will. Thank you. Right, so I'll start by reading a list of 108 types of Jaina karma, and then I'll explicate each in turn, which, as you appreciate, is a joke. I have to say, it'll be blazingly obvious from this paper that I'm not a philosopher. And this really is an ascetic exercise after the riches of our previous paper in terms of, I don't know what intellectual content, I think, probably. Really what this amounts to is a kind of hypothesis about the omniscience of the Jinna or Tirthankara, sort of explicated in terms of categories. You may find this hypothesis completely unexceptional and indeed superficial and trivial, and I'm sure you'll tell me if that's the case, or go on scribbling on your sheets and so on, and ignoring it, and that's fine. I mean, I'm not sure myself about the status of this particular hypothesis. What I've done really is revisit some texts that I was once more familiar with than I am now, but they seem to have served my purpose to some point in making this argument. So, sometime between the 2nd and 4th centuries CE, the Jain monk Umaswati compiled the first systematic compendium of Jaina thought in Sanskrit, and he called it the Tattvata Sutra, or, to use Paul Dundas's translation, the Mnemonic Rules on the Meaning of the Reals, capital letters. It came to be considered such an encyclopedic concentration of the elements of Jain thought that, with some slight variations, it was subsequently accepted as authoritative by both the major divisions of the Jaina community, the Shvetambaras and the Digambaras. And as Dundas remarks, it was probably actually composed before the sectarian division had fully crystallized. The text, divided into 10 chapters or sections, combines the ontological with the taxonomic, or, to put it another way, categorization with classification. I should say I'm not intending to make some fine distinction here. It's actually my convention to use these terms to try and make it easier to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not intended to be, what was it called this morning, a chuller. It's not supposed to be a quibble on the meanings of these terms. I mean, you could just as well say sort of subcategorization as classification, I guess. So its contents are derived from the perception that everything that exists is either a sentient entity, jiva, or a non-sentient entity, ajiva. So it's this ontological dualism which constitutes the two basic categories of Jain thought. The rest can be regarded or classified perhaps as classification or subcategorization or whatever you like. This can be illustrated by looking at two key sutras in the text itself. First, at the Tattvata Sutra 1.4, we are given a list of 7 tattvas, or reals. Tatya glosses this as categories of truth, but Dixit's fundamental things is probably more helpful, as well as probably a bit less confusing in the present context. So these 7 tattvas are jiva, which are sentient entities, or souls as they're sometimes translated, ajiva, non-sentient entities, astrava, influx of karmic particles, bandha, bondage, so karmic particles obviously, sangvara, stoppage of the influx, nijara, shedding or falling away, getting rid of the karmic particles, and moksha, liberation. So essentially these tattvas are facts about the nature of existence, whatever that means, which enable those who analyse them properly, so by definition, jivas at a certain level of sentience, enables them to plot their route to liberation. So we have the two basic ontological categories, jiva and ajiva, followed by five tattvas, which first of all give an account of, or although obviously not an ultimate explanation for, the jiva's bondage by non-sentient karmic matter, and then a blueprint for escaping that bondage and attaining liberation, moksha. Or, to put it another way, it demonstrated that although the bondage of the sentient by the non-sentient is a given, and so an experienced reality, if you like, it's nevertheless not ineluctable. After some discussion of epistemology, the Tattvata Sutra then proceeds to analyse the nature of the jiva, the kinds of material bodies it can inhabit from birth to birth, and the extent of the cosmos in which it may find itself re-embodied. When the text turns to a more detailed discussion of ajiva, it starts with an expanded definition of non-sentient entities as being composed of the media of motion, dharma, and rest, adharma, don't ask, space, akasha, and matter, pudgala. It's a sort of second key sutra. Although when combined with the jiva, these are commonly referred to as the five ontological categories, a gloss of Panchastikaya, they are in fact simply a more detailed restatement of the categorization of what exists, substances or dravya, according to the Tattvata Sutra. A restatement of that in terms of the two basic ontological categories, sentient and non-sentient. As Paul Dundas points out, this kind of analysis is actually absent from the earliest book of the Shvetambara canon, the Acharanga Sutra, which makes no mention of the ajiva category, merely dividing existence into those which have thought and those which do not. In fact, the kind of elaborate classification we find in the Tattvata Sutra in general, for instance in the five remaining chapters, 6 to 10, which proceed to deal with the five other tattvas, including the kind of painstaking classification of various karmas, for which the Jains are famous or notorious, depending on your point of view, elaborate classification is largely absent from the very earliest texts. Of course, the Tattvata Sutra is building on other texts, and this doesn't come anew in the Tattvata Sutra, but it seemed to be the very earliest text. You don't have normally have this kind of elaborate classification. However, given that these early texts were written by ascetics for ascetics, and that they are concerned with the justification and routinization of particular kinds of ascetic conduct, we may reasonably suppose that the elaboration we find exemplified both in the Tattvata Sutra and in some of the texts from which it draws is merely a continuation of this ascetic strategy. To put this in ethical terms, given the eventual realization of the early Jaina teachers that harm done to other sentient beings was harm done to oneself, it became essential to establish a categorical, in other words, an impermeable differentiation between what is living or sentient and what is not. For it was only in this way that any kind of monastic code could be instituted. Once this fundamental differentiation or categorization had been made, however, it was taxonomy, a classification on the basis of the pre-established categories, which became the primary tool for circumscribing and assessing the karmic outcome of ascetic behaviour across a range of possible activities. A further development from this was that progress towards liberation was then classified in terms of particular karmas and the individual's ability to suppress or eliminate them, rather than solely in terms of the physical restraint which both engendered and reflected such states. So at Tattvata Sutra 947, for instance, we find the combination of external restraint and internal suppression mapped onto 10 stages of the so-called spiritual development, in what's clearly a precursor of the classical 14 stages known as Gunastanas. So quickly to run through those 10, you've got the suppression or elimination of karmic particles increases innumerably at each of the 10 stages of spiritual development, which are 1, the possessor of enlightened worldview, 2, the lay learner, Shravaka, practicing partial abstinence, 3, the ascetic practicing complete abstinence, 4, the ascetic suppressing or eliminating the tenacious passions, 5, the ascetic eliminating view-deluding karma, and the way karma and passions are interchangeable here, 6, the ascetic suppressing conduct-deluding karma, 7, the ascetic who has suppressed conduct-deluding karma, 8, the ascetic eliminating conduct-deluding karma, 9, the ascetic who has eliminated conduct-deluding karma, and, of course, top, the victor, the jinnah. So you could say that taxonomy led, or is a concomitant of, internalization and abstraction. The proliferation of classification and the development of a monastic code is in many ways obvious, I think, especially when through internalization, in other words, an emphasis on the suppression of passions and other negative internal states, as opposed to entirely external restraints. Some of the benefits of asceticism are extended to those in the lay community who are intent on controlling themselves. What perhaps is less obvious is that the development of an elaborate taxonomy of karmas linked to a hierarchy of embodiments and multiple cosmic levels can also be read as representing a change in the way in which writers such as Umaswati represented the Jain community both to itself and to the rest of the world. It was a shift, moreover, which was predicated on the promotion of a particular kind of totalizing knowledge as an instrument of both social definition and personal liberation. So the knowledge I refer to here is the Jaina understanding of omniscience, variously termed Kevalik Jnana, Kevalik Darshana, Savaknyata, Savaknyata, and so on. In the Tattvata Sutra, Kevalik Jnana is defined as extending to all substances in all their modes simultaneously. And the first Digambara commentary on the Tattvata Sutra, Pujipada's Savata Siddhi, leaves us in no doubt about the scope of what is intended. And I'll read this in translation. I think this was one of the papers that was distributed before. And so if you want to see the Sanskrit, it's in the footnotes there. This, in fact, is I said Jain's translation of this. First, the souls are infinite times infinite. The forms of matter are still more infinite times infinite. Atoms and molecules are the divisions of matter, the medium of motion, the medium of rest, and space are three substances. Time is innumerable. The modes of each of these, extending through the past, the present, and the future, are infinite times infinite. And there is nothing, either substance or mode, which does not come within the purview of omniscience. So the vocabulary here, substance, dravya, mode, pariyaya, anticipates the definition of the existent, sat, or reality, which is given at Savata Siddhi 529, so it's the Digambara version of Tattvata Siddhi 529. So there, sat is equated with dravya, or substance, sat dravya lakshanam. Sat is further defined in the following sutra as origination, destruction, and permanence together, padavyan dravya yuktam sat. That's to say, a substance, dravya, is constituted of permanence and change. Moreover, at Tattvata Sutra 538, a substance, dravya, is said to be possessed of qualities, gunas, and modes, pariyayas. According to the commentaries, what distinguishes qualities from modes is the fact that the former are permanent, that is to say, they always reside in a substance. More specifically, its qualities are what distinguish one substance from another. A living being, for instance, is said to possess consciousness or cognition, and that distinguishes it from matter. What is clear, however, is that sat, taken as a whole, is a permanent dravya possessed of ever-changing pariyaras. As we've seen, the jiva, the sentient entity, or soul if you like, is characterized as a dravya, although a non-material one, as opposed to pudgala, which is by definition consists of atoms. Given that the soul is a substance or existent, like all other dravyas, it is both permanent and subject to change or modification. Its chief quality, what distinguishes it from other substances, is consciousness, chaitanya. and obscured that consciousness comprehends all things in all their qualities and modes simultaneously. And as we've already noted, that is what the Jains mean by omniscience. Now, two related sets of questions arise from this. First, there's the question of what it might mean subjectively to have this kind of knowledge. In other words, is it possible to imagine what the experience of comprehending reality in all of all its modes and qualities and modes simultaneously might be like? Or is Kaivalya Jnana in this sense merely some kind of scholastic elaboration, a theoretical construct, the reality of which is assumed but not imagined, not only because, perhaps like the Vedantic Brahman, it's unimaginable, but also because nothing of significance hangs on being able to do so. I think this becomes clearer if we turn to a more immediately answerable set of questions, namely, who experiences Kaivalya Jnana? Who is supposed to experience this simultaneous, comprehensive knowledge of everything that has, is, and will exist? How, according to Jaina thought, are those beings whose consciousness is unobscured by karmas, who experience the sum total of all possible categories and classifications, classified themselves? The Tathagata Sutra and its commentaries make a distinction between the attainment of omniscience, kevala, and the attainment of complete liberation, moksha. While the former is an earnest of the latter, it can nevertheless be experienced in an embodied state, albeit the omniscient jivas, the kevalin's final such state. The texts therefore make a further distinction between those who experience omniscience while still embodied, the arhats or jinnas and tadankas, and other embodied kevalins on the one hand, and the siddhas who have attained moksha on the other. So siddha is the more inclusive category since it covers all those erstwhile kevalins and arhats who have now attained moksha and are permanently beyond contact in the siddha loka, where they, to quote Paul Dundas, exist perpetually without any further rebirth in a disembodied and genderless state of perfect joy, energy, consciousness and knowledge. Apart from perhaps joy and consciousness, the defining characteristic of the jiva, we may ask what use these qualities, including knowledge, could possibly be to the liberated, since they cannot act on them. In other words, use them in any ordinary sense. This in itself, I think, suggests that such qualities are almost entirely reflexes or consequences of doctrines whose real scope or efficacy is confined to pre-moksha experience. Omniscience, or Kaivalya Jnana in particular, seems to be of no subjective use or benefit to those who have attained the siddha loka. The Savata Siddhi, in asserting their interdependence, simply compounds the impression. Quote, the concomitant characteristics of knowledge and perception, such as infinite energy, also remain in liberated souls, for without infinite energy there can be no infinite knowledge, and bliss is of the nature of knowledge. And I'm not sure about bliss here, and probably that needs to be more closely considered. It's probably worth noting in passing that the problems raised by the concept of omniscience in Western and theistic thought, as far as I understand them, in other words, its relation to both omnipotence and free will, just don't arise for the actionless and atheistic Jains. So, if the attribution of Kaivalya Jnana to the liberated is not primarily an incentive to become liberated oneself, what is its purpose? To understand this, we have to note first that the Jains make a distinction between embodied and disembodied kevalins. The latter, the disembodied kevalins, are the siddhas, the blissfully inert, karma-free and isolated denizens of the siddha loka at the apex of the universe. The former, the embodied kevalins, in other words, those who have attained omniscience but are yet to shed the non-harming karmas which provide them with a physical body and so a material presence in the world, there are two types of classes. Those who teach, in other words, the jinnas, also known as arhats or tirthankaras, and those who don't. Since the appearance of jinnas is karmically and cosmically conditioned, this is actually a distinction between those who can and those who can't teach, in the sense of allowed to or not. Retirement from teaching from Mahavira's immediate disciples, or Gunadharas, once they achieved Kevala Jnana, was therefore compulsory, not voluntary. As Padmanabh Jaini remarks, according to the tradition, a typical lifespan for a Gunadhara after the attainment of omniscience was 16 years. So this was 16 years without either translating, according to the Digambaras, or compiling and organising, according to the Shvetambaras, the Dharma, as taught by the Jina. As Jaini puts it, with the attainment of omniscience, their clerical activities came to an end. lucky gee. Thereafter, they were Gunadharas in name only. Thus it would seem that whatever transmission of the Jina's teaching these Gunadharas had performed must have taken place during their pre-omniscience careers as ordinary mendicants. Or, to adapt an expression from another tradition, it's truly a case of most of those who know don't speak. The reasons for this restriction in the nature of the knowledge transmitted by non-jinnas is not strictly relevant to the current argument, although I suppose some of them can easily be imagined, not least the need to protect the uniformity of the jinnas' teaching. What is more significant, I think, is the clear understanding by the tradition that among those who have attained Kevala Jnana, it is only the embodied jinna who teaches. Therefore, it is only the jinna who articulates objectively, as opposed to experiencing subjectively, his infallible knowledge to others. It remains the case, however, that the full scope of the jinna's omniscience can hardly be conveyed to the non-omniscient. After all, it is only the kevalins who are able to cognize what lies beyond the senses. And yet, because the jinna is omniscient, anything he does say about the world, however limited its scope, is necessarily true. And to put this in a wider epistemological context, Ole Kvarnström, in his discussion of the Jain Mimamsa debate on omniscience, points out that the Jains, like the Mimamsakas, quote, held that the source of all knowledge presided beyond the objects of the senses and was identical to Dharma. And while the human mind was a major source of distortion, which was incapable of directly experiencing Dharma, omniscience was viewed by the Jains as an inherent faculty, a form of cognition independent of the mind and the senses, and so a direct means of acquiring valid knowledge of Dharma. In the Tattvata Sutra, Umaswati distinguishes between two classes of valid knowledge: indirect or acquired, paroksha, and direct or innate, pratyaksha. Sensory knowledge or perception, mati and what is heard, shruta, in other words, textual knowledge, are indirect. Clairvoyance, mind reading, and omniscience are direct. The important point for the present discussion is to note that shruta, although indirect, is validated by the direct knowledge of Kevala Jnana in a way analogous to Smriti's validation by Shruti in the Brahmanical tradition. As the 6th century CE grammarian Pujyapada puts it in his commentary on Tattvata Sutra 112, scripture presupposes the omniscient. He goes on in his commentary on Tattvata Sutra 120 to spell out how this should be related to the extant Jaina teachings. Quote, the teachers are of three kinds, namely the omniscient Tirthankara, his disciples, and the later preceptors, Shrutikevalas and Acharyas. The scriptures were really taught by the omniscient Tirthankara, gifted with perfect knowledge of unimaginable power and splendour. The Lord is free from all kinds of impurities and is possessed of direct and perfect knowledge, hence his word is authoritative. The Lord's chief disciples, called Gunadharas, gifted with vast knowledge, recollect the import of the Lord's teachings and compose works called Angas and Purvas, in other words, the surviving canon and its lost predecessor. Going on with the quote, these are also authoritative, as these are only interpretations of the word of the Lord. Later on, shorter works such as Dashavaikalika, which is a monastic text about how to behave as a monk, are written by the later preceptors to benefit their disciples, whose lives are shorter and whose intellect and energy are less potent owing to the nature of the times. These also constitute valid knowledge, as these are in fact the same as the Ungers and Purvas in a condensed form, just as the water of the Milky Ocean taken in a jar. Or as Haribhadra put it in the 8th century CE, an omniscient being's existence, quote, and this quote from Kwanstrom, can be confirmed on the basis of the Jaina scriptures, Agama, since the idea of omniscience is a result of their prescriptive statements, and like perception, pratyaksha, these Jaina scriptures contain intrinsic validity and are eternal like the Veda. Moreover, unlike sensory knowledge, mati, which is only concerned with objects that exist in the present, scriptural knowledge relates to objects of all three phases of time, past, present, and future. Unlike the Jinnah's Kevalignana, which also relates to past, present, and future, scriptural knowledge is obviously and necessarily incomplete. But this is not to suggest, as some mistaken readings of Anekantavada have supposed, that the Jaina tradition regards its authoritative texts as open to doubt. On the contrary, they are seen as an accurate and intrinsically valid representation of part of the Jinnah's total knowledge. Insofar as anything is up for debate, it is not what exists in the texts, but what exists beyond them. But since such knowledge is supersensory, it is in itself only available to Kevalins, or at least to those who have made Kevalin like karmic progress, according to Jaina textual prescriptions. We can therefore be sure that it will not contradict textual knowledge, merely expand its scope. As the texts and their commentaries provide us with more and ever more complex detail about the cosmos and its denizens, this is not therefore regarded by the tradition as scholastic elaboration or speculation, but as a further revelation of a portion of the Jinnah's total knowledge. What is being classified, therefore, is the universe as reflected in, i.e. directly perceived by, the Jinnah's soul, and transmitted to us through his teachings. In a typical circularity, the more complex the formulation, the more baroque the taxonomy, the more this reinforces the authority and validity of the teaching. For those taught, the anticipated reaction may be something like, this is so extraordinary, so complex, so all-encompassing that only an omniscient being could know the details of it. So, in this objective pre-moksha articulation of a portion of the Jinnah's total knowledge, it is this objective pre-moksha articulation of a portion of the Jinnah's total knowledge which makes clear what I was going to call the real function of omniscience in Jaina thought, but that's probably putting it too strongly, but a particular function of omniscience in Jaina thought, it's probably better to say that. It's essentially a strategy to validate not only the authority of the canonical texts, but also the teaching of the tradition in the widest sense. And I think this impression is borne out indirectly by the canonical accounts of the Jinnah's lives. Since they are equally omniscient, all Jinnahs are supposed to deliver the same essential teaching. This uniformity is extended to their biographies, which are largely stereotyped and follow that established for Mahavira and the Kalpa Sutra. While the account given there is detailed in its treatment of the Jinnah's pre-omniscience life, after the point at which he becomes a Kevalin, there is just one further sentence listing the locations of his rainy season retreats, followed immediately by the date, time, and place of his physical death. Nothing is said there, at least, about what he did during his 30 years as an omniscient teacher. And that suggests there's no need. It's the teaching, the taxonomy that counts, not the life. The gap from becoming omniscient to physical death is taken up precisely with everything. It's the gap into which every one of the innumerable existence, dravya, in all its qualities and modes, past, present, and future, is simultaneously reflected. And what in the canonical texts and the teaching of the tradition is perceived as being drawn out of this is a necessarily incomplete, but nevertheless authoritative and comprehensible form, is a taxonomy that mirrors the way things really are. Such an elaborate taxonomy becomes in time self-validating, a collective and almost literally weighty doctrinal assertion that the way in which the Jains classify the universe reflects its true nature. followed, of course, by the further assertion that the behavioural lessons drawn from this picture of the universe are the only appropriate ones for those who wish to make spiritual progress. In short, classification is the means of conceptual colonisation. As Paul Dundas, perhaps less aggressively, puts it in his discussion of giant cosmology, quote, the classical description of the loka, the universe, provided by the giant cosmographers, is uniquely giant and is one which provides a fully and internally consistent picture of the universe, in which the only values which hold sway are those of Jainism. The loka is thus an emblem of religious identity and separateness through which the Jains could differentiate themselves from other religions. This development from the simple categorical differentiation of jiva and ajiva to an elaborate taxonomy both reflects and accompanies the way in which the Jain community developed from a loose association of ascetic groups to a religious tradition with a lay following, one which was in competition both economically and intellectually with other Indian religions. It can, of course, be argued that the dualism of jiva and ajiva remains the axis around which ascetically conditioned practices and distinctively Jain ethical values, particularly non-violence, continue to turn. But even if we acknowledge that, it hardly prepares us for the way in which one Jain thinker in particular returned to this fundamental categorical division and reappraised it from the perspective of self-knowledge rather than ascetic in action. Perhaps it's no coincidence that the works ascribed to this thinker, the Digambara scholar Kundakunda, began to appear at approximately the same time that the Jain preoccupation with taxonomy was reaching its apogee, sometime, I would say, between the 5th and 7th century CE. I don't want to go into a debate about the dates of Kundakunda here, and I should say in fairness that the tradition, the Digambara tradition, wants to date him much earlier, after the 1st century. At one level, these texts participate as fully as the Tattvata Sutra in the classification of the universe. But at another, and this is certainly what makes them distinctive, their major concern is to formulate a univocal soteriological response to the fundamental categorical dualism of Jaina thought. This takes the form of an assertion that the self, which everyone calls the Atman here, Atman or Jiva, of its very nature cannot be implicated in matter. The fact that it appears to be so is just that, an appearance, and subjectively a delusion. The solution to this essentially unreal karmic bondage is therefore to realise, through meditation, the true, already liberated nature of the self. To understand the implications of this, we can return to the question of knowledge and omniscience. Umaswati's Jainism, starting from the premise that knowledge is innate, explained the experience of ignorance in terms of the real bondage of the non-material soul by something essentially different from itself, so karmic matter. Such a view is supported by the perspective of Anekantavada, which holds that in the world, in unliberated experience, if I'll get the Sundays right, while the soul is unchanged in its essence or substance, it is ever-changing, i.e. affected by karma, in its modifications or modes. In short, it is innately omniscient, but really bound. Knowledge, experience, is therefore limited, partial, and occluded, and must remain so this side of the removal of all obscuring karma, something that can only be achieved through ascetic practice. Knowledge, from this perspective, cannot be salvific. It cannot pull itself up by its own bootstraps. The well-known line from the Acharanga Sutra, "He who knows one knows all, and he who knows all knows one," is therefore taken as a description of the experience of the omniscient Jinnah, not as a prescription for those seeking liberation. Starting from essentially the same premise, that knowledge is innate, Kundakunda arrives at a different solution to the problem of ignorance. It is specific knowledge about the true nature of the self and its relation to matter that is liberating. Moreover, knowledge, innate knowledge, is not simply knowledge of the self, but it is identical with it. Statements such as "he who knows one knows all" are therefore essentially prescriptive in an almost Upanishadic manner, perhaps, for Kundakunda, the significant one being the self. So according to Kundakunda's Samayasara, the self, the knower, and knowledge are in essence one. But to attain this state, to become the pure self, it is necessary to realize, that's to say, to experience this theoretical truth in the self. So how's this to be done? The ignorant self binds itself through identifying with what is not self. As the Samayasara puts it, the soul, jiva, is full of ignorance, mistaking the non-self for the self, he uses Atman there, and the self for what is non-self is the agent of karmas. Conversely, the soul which consists of knowledge, not mistaking the non-self for the self, or the self for what is non-self, is not the agent of karmas. The essential mental act is therefore discrimination based on knowledge of the true nature of the self. With increasing stress on the essential purity of the self and its equation with knowledge, omniscience, the idea has arisen that the soul, or Atman, in its essence, or Swabhava, and he uses this term, cannot by definition ever really come into contact with any material substances. And what was originally true just for the individual who had attained Kaivalya Jnana is now predicated of every soul. It is precisely knowledge of this which is instrumental in separating self and not self. In other words, such knowledge causes the self to relinquish its unreal or delusory contact with the other and thus realize its true condition. What this amounts to is that separation of the jiva and what binds it is no longer a physical matter, i.e. it's not a matter of burning off karma through austerities and preventing further influx through inaction, it is now an intellectual or mental concern. One realizes the true nature of the self through prajna, sort of discriminative wisdom, perhaps. I mean, you can see his vocabulary is eclectic, so at least. That in itself releases the pure self, this discriminative prajna. It enables it to attain its true condition. In short, it is the experience of the pure self, rather than simply intellectual knowledge of it, that is liberating, an experience achieved through meditation. Don't ask me what form this meditation actually took. In a similar way, renunciation is also internalized. Stress now falls upon the renunciation of all mental states, or bhavas. Consequently, it is not the physical objects themselves which make up the ajiva world which are to be renounced, but the attitude towards those objects. Negatively, therefore, renunciation is the rejection of delusion and wrong attitude. Positively, it is the realization of the true nature of the self, or Swabhava. This constitutes, and we're back with the old two truths thing, this constitutes Kundakunda's higher or non-conventional perspective, his Nishchaya point of view, the way things are in reality. It can be summarized as follows. The self is not an actor, it is karma that is the real agent, but in reality karma does not and cannot have any effect on the self. Therefore, not only is any action by the self a delusion, but so too is bondage. This is what one must realize in order to attain liberation. So where does this leave the jinnah's omniscience and its validation of the tradition? According to Kundakunda, it survives as a conventional or practical Vyavahara point of view. His Niyamasara puts it like this. From the Vyavahara, the conventional point of view, the omniscient Lord sees and knows everything. From the Nishchaya, higher or non-conventional point of view, the omniscient sees and knows the self. So, on the one hand, we have the objective pre-moksha omniscience of the jinnah, the validation of the teaching and the taxonomy. On the other, we have the subjective innate omniscience of the self, which is rooted in a basic categorical distinction between self and non-self. This subjective omniscience is, moreover, self-validating insofar as it can be tested individually and experientially. To put this even more starkly, you could say that on the one hand, we have an emblem of the historical jhana tradition, and the way in which it has come to present itself to the world. On the other, we have an emblem of the solitary ascetic who attempts to replicate the subjective experience of Mahavira and the other jinnahs. Although, as I've argued elsewhere, there is, what I think strong evidence that Kunda Kunda regarded his non-conventional view as superior to the conventional one, i.e. true in an absolute sense. There is no doubt that the mainstream traditions, both Shvetambara and Digambara, and in fact including most of Kunda Kunda's commentators, ignored this in favour of the conventional viewpoint. Or to put it in terms of the present argument, the colonised universe, the wider community prevails, you could say prevails again, over the solitary meditating ascetic. Kunda Kunda was in one sense a fundamentalist, in that he returned to the basic categorical differentiation which underlies all Jain thought and practice, and attempted, from one point of view, to bypass the great taxonomy which has grown up around it. But as the traditions themselves clearly recognised, the survival of the Jains as a discrete and identifiable community required something else.
Well, thank you for that very rich perhaps I could just start by asking for a bit more on that pentad we had at the beginning, since I'm a bit dedicated to them. After the Jiva and Ajiva, we had a pentad.
Yes,
does it
right.
relate at all to any of the other ones that we've encountered in the last couple of days?
Well, it didn't, put it this way, I didn't consciously register that it did when I was listening to the others, but that may be my deficiency, rather than the fact that it doesn't relate to it. I mean, others may be better able to answer that than I am, I guess. I mean, it is a very giant thing. I mean, obviously, it's about karma, essentially, the influx of karma, the binding of karma, how you get rid of it, and then total absence of karma, liberation. So it's it has that soteriological bent to it. Beyond that, I'm afraid I can't say whether it relates to any of the others or not.
Is it would you see it as a hierarchy, for instance? I mean, moksha as the sort of summit, and the others as lower value steps leading towards.
Well, yes, I mean, that's certainly true in practical terms, yeah. Mm. Yes. I mean, if you start from, which is where the Jains inevitably start, the fact that they're embodied in the world, and as far as they're concerned, that's always been the case. And how do you get out of it? Well, yes, this is the way to get out of it.
And the first, what was the first stage, which I couldn't really hear?
There was Jiva and Ajiva. So
after that...
Asrava, which is to do this sort of rushing in of karmic particles because of your the way in which you've behaved, or the combinations of ways in which you've behaved. In a Muswati system, it's to do with acting in a passionate way which attracts karmic particles.
So that's obviously pretty negative, yes.
Yes, you don't want that.
Yeah. Johannes.
You talk about omniscience, and you seem to suggest, but correct me if I misunderstood you, that omniscience comes in somewhat later in the development in Jainism to kind of put its stamp of approval on a meanwhile rather elaborate system. Now, what I wanted to say is that there is a Buddhist passage, I think, where the Jains are talked about, as they are in a number of occasions, and where, I can't cite precisely where it is or what form it takes exactly, but somehow it has the form, our master, that is the Jina, who knows all and something else, he teaches this and that.
Right, yes.
Are you aware of that passage?
Yes, but I got. I wasn't seeking to suggest that somehow it was something later that, as you say, comes in as a stamp. It may well be there from very, very early on, but in a way, that passage is sort of making that point making this seems to be making a similar point, you know, having recourse to this unimpeachable authority here, because he knows everything, then it's bound to be true. I mean, I'm just suggesting that, you know, as you get a flowering of this later on, then you've always got the Jinnah's omniscience to go to. To justify it. I'm not saying that somehow they artificially imported it to try and make sense of it later. No, that wasn't my intention. And of course, I mean, there's a fair amount of or at least academic debate about what the Buddha means by omniscience, as you know, and what the Jinnah might mean by it, and so on. And they seem to be rather different. I mean, as I understand it.
Mikhail?
I wonder, Will, whether you could elaborate a bit on... I know you said you didn't want to tell us, or you didn't want to speculate about the form of meditation that Kunda was recommending, but just after the reference to meditation, you said that... there was a shift from renunciation of objects to renunciation of a particular kind of attitude towards those objects. And so presumably the meditative practice is the means of achieving that shift of attitude.
Well, I suppose meditation in a very loose sense, but I mean that kind of shift is there, I would think, from fairly early in the Jain tradition to some extent. I mean, I think the two things run in parallel, that certainly the ascetic tradition won't relinquish its tie to physical asceticism, I mean, for all kinds of reasons. But at the same time, you're either adding to that through an internal attitude of renunciation, or perhaps you could argue, and I sometimes have argued in the past, I'm not sure how strong I want to argue it now, that... you can detect some kind of shift to something that's more compatible with lay concerns. At least lay people can deal with this better because they can do it internally without necessarily having the external ascetic restraints. Whether that will take them as far as doing both is another matter. I mean, so it's very, very basic, most basic, I suppose. It's just a sort of shift in attitude, in a way that you've got to take care of attachment, that's an almost Buddhist sense, as well as everything else. But then, in terms of Kunda, I mean, it's something else again, which is the sort of internalization, as it were, of the fact that you're not actually, that your jiva is not actually connected with karma and with matter in any way. I don't know what happens, you know, what methods, or indeed whether any specific methods were properly developed for doing that amongst the Jains. And certainly Kunda remains a sort of, at that level, remains a minority figure at the level of his Nishchaya view. But presumably, I mean, that's simply what I think you infer from the text, that you've got to deal with that somehow internally. And so meditation is a rather loose term for that, I guess. But
I just come back on that briefly. Philosophically, it's interesting to consider the relationship between change of attitude and change of behaviour. There seems to be a sharp distinction being made between change of behaviour and change of attitude, insofar as it's being proposed that one can change the attitude without changing the behaviour. Or is that a dubious reading?
Well, I suppose the two sort of go hand in hand. I mean, it's already there, and saying a bit earlier about Ashrava by the time you've got Tattvata Sutra, you've got an idea that it's only actions accompanied by passions, negative emotions, that cause really binding karma. I mean, karma keeps coming in, but it doesn't stick, not to put this too crudely, and it flows through in the short term. But if you've got passions there, if you've got a negative emotional state, as it were, while this is happening, then you're in trouble. It's going to stay with you, and you're going to have a long process to get rid of it again. That's it. But I mean, the process. Of course, you have no way as an individual of quantifying this, or really, or I mean, certain instances you might be aware, well, that wasn't a good thing to have happened, or whatever. And of course, you don't know what's happened in the past. I mean, we're in a system of karma and rebirth, and so the ascetic practice is going to be necessary. You're going to have to burn off your unquantifiable karma if you want to make progress. I mean, as well, it's almost a double whammy, really. I mean, they're getting you on both fronts, I suppose. Yeah.
Johannes?
We don't know what happened in the past, at least not as much as we would like, but we know at least some things, namely that Jainism, like Buddhism, at an early stage moved to the kind of outposts in the southeast in particular, and Karnataka, and probably in early centuries they saw more Buddhists than they ever saw Brahmins, because they left from the far away, they went to places far away from the Brahmanical heartland.
Right.
And that, of course, left its traces, as I showed in an article a few years ago.
Yeah.
In the Jain Shvetambara canon, there is a great deal of demonstrable influence from Abhidharma Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
Unrecognized, of course, as always. I mean,
yeah.
They don't say before, it is there. Quite a number of notions pop up. And then we have this period where apparently, I find this, now I'm speculating, and I don't know what it's worth, this notion of omniscience. You put it in parallel with Mimamsa. And I wonder, I think that is a very good comparison, and I even wonder if it is more than just a chance parallel, because both now had a textual tradition which was absolutely infallible, really down to the last bit, so to say, because of the omniscience of the Jina on the one hand, and because of the non-origin of the Veda on the other. Now that is something that I'm not fully clear about, I speculate. But then Kunda again, he starts treating Jainism pretty much the way Jainism worked, with its soul that doesn't act. I mean, and so on. That's precisely what I mentioned yesterday in my paper.
Yeah.
This is a feature that is predominant in the Brahmanical philosophies, in Sankhya, very obviously so, and in yoga. In Vaisheshika, a little bit more hidden but clearly present. In Jainism, absent, but then with Kundakunda, there it comes. And not to stay, unfortunately, so to say, but which suggests that Jainism, at least for this period where we have some idea of where they hang out, so to say, were all the time influenced by the people they met and the other currents. To some extent, this is speculation. To some extent, we can show it, I think, in the case of Abhidharma influence on the canon, I think it can be shown. Kundakunda and his relation to this particular Sankhya-like development is, I think, beyond doubt. So far too little, but what we know is quite challenging.
I'm sure you're right. It needs contextualizing. What I said needs contextualizing much further in that respect. But
And of course, sorry, if there is no other question, only that.
Oh, you go ahead.
What's his name? The Tathagata Sutra, Umaswati, is I guess he's one of the first to use Sanskrit.
Yes, I mean, he's generally said to be the first to write this kind of work anyway in Sanskrit, as far as the...
And that means interaction with Brahmanism.
Yep.
And it also means, and I like that phrase, which I underlined in my copy of your paper, Umasvati represented a giant community both to itself and to the rest of the world. And that is obviously
yes.
true, because Sanskrit was kind of stepping out of the strict limits of the giant tradition. And
that's what I was getting at.
Certainly.
Yeah. Yes, of course, Kunda goes back to using a form of Prakrit, although all his commentators use Sanskrit.
Yeah.
Kevin?
I was interested in your distinction between the siddhas and the jinnas, I think. One was omniscient and the other one wasn't.
No, they're both omniscient, but only the jinnas are qualified to teach before they leave their body.
Right. And did the community, the joint community, think that this state can be achieved in the present life? And if so, how do you recognize a siddha?
Well, yes, I mean, they come to tie the whole question of the appearance of jinnas to time, cycles of time. So Mahavira's the most recent, and certainly in this part of the universe, there won't be one for very much longer. And then somehow a sort of match is made between hearing a jinnah teaching and being capable of attaining liberation. And if you can't hear a jinnah teaching, then you're in for the long haul, really. Apart from the fact that time is wound down to such an extent that it's not going to happen anyway. So, you could say, I mean, if you're being cynical about it, you could say, well, this is a way of protecting the jinnah's teaching from variation. Somebody pops up and says, well, I'm an omniscient being, and I've got a completely different set of categories which I'm going to spiel off. That's how effectively how it works. They're in the past just for practical purposes, or in the far future.
I looked at a Laidlaw's book a few years ago, Riches and Uncertainty, and I can't remember who it was, but there was a saint in there who succeeded in starving himself to death over a number of years, I think. But I think he was regarded as a I'm just wondering how the community...
Well, all kinds of people may be regarded on that kind of level. I suppose the proof is in the teaching or not. I mean, this may be one reason why the Kanata is full silent after they become omniscient. Well, they don't want to be in competition, really, with what their teacher's saying. Or at least in the heads of people in competition, and it may be that anyone who claims to be a siddha, I mean, you might get away with it. Well, you're not saying anything. I'm not sure you get away with it if you started teaching. It's
Yes.
I'm wondering, there's in this little book by Hauptfass on Kumara and Shankara, he's addressing the question of pluralism. Or at least how Shankara looks at pluralism, and he points to passages in Shankara where he says that scripture is like a kind teacher, who takes in account the abilities of the student and the audience, and so. This is a nice, and he says this is also present in Buddhism, though I don't remember exactly where.
Sort of skillful means.
Skillful means, right?
Yeah.
That so that this is a really nice hermeneutical tool for getting around conflicts in scripture, and you would think that such an idea would fit in very well with Rene Kantavada. But I'm just wondering, is this picked up by the giants? There seems a sort of nice nexus of the pluralism-friendly ideas in Jainism with the Ahimsa and Anekantavada and the Saptabhangi. And I wonder...
Well,
yes,
I mean...
On the other hand, you have this Sarvajnyatva that really...
conflicts with this nexus of ideas.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say it complements it rather than complements it in the sense that what all that is pointing to is to, in my view, and I'm sure many giants and perhaps others wouldn't agree with me, because I mean they tend to see Anikantavar as being Siyadvaj and so on as being non-violent at the intellectual level and allowing other people's views and so on. But it seems to me that the whole system is predicated on the omniscience of the jinnah. The common story that's told about this is the universal one of the blind men and the elephant or whatever and saying what it is. But it seems to me the giant version of that is entirely predicated on the idea that there is somebody who can actually see the elephant in its entirety. There's something that and has completely authoritative knowledge of what's going on, and that's a jinnah. And the best way you can get, the nearest you can get to him, is to go through the giant texts or through the giant teachers. I really don't think there's any sort of radically throwing things up and saying, oh, well, maybe it's true or maybe it's not. My own view about Danny Kantavada is that it's there to make to keep the connection between to keep a real connection between the jiva, the soul, and matter. I mean, I think that's its function. Of course, it comes to function in other ways, in particular in the modern era, where it becomes a byword for tolerance, and they then get into ethics and so on. But I'm not convinced that that's how it started out. Others may have different views about this.
Jessica?
Just briefly following on from that, wondering similar questions. Is Anikantavada then ultimately really quite a practical thing? We're allowing for a plurality of views in a time of plural sects, and nevertheless the omniscient one has a determinate answer? Or is this actually also still playing a sort of a metaphysical role where... is it that the omniscient one, when he sees the truth, realizes that in fact the elephant isn't simply an elephant, it is in fact many, many truths? I'm curious about that, because we keep coming up with the idea that categories are themselves composites of categories with different possible divisions.
No, I don't, I mean, without knowing what the omniscient one thinks, I doubt that he's taking that attitude, really. I mean, or at least from the perspective of the giant tradition, he's taking that attitude.
Truth that the omniscient one sees, not a plurality of indeterminate truths in conjunction in some way.
Well, that's certainly the way I would take it, but yes.
Yes, there was just a slight response to Stephen Cook's question, and that is, in the case of Kundakunda, this is what I would send to you in the thesis, there is a way in which the Nishcha and the Vibharana are used as pedagogical tools, and I interpreted in that case the use of Anikantavad, I sort of differed from you,
right,
in that it is used, it is interpreted in a sort of a sociological, it does have certain connotations, it's not purely epistemological, I think, which is, it's a while since I did that thesis, I can't remember everything, but in that case, that was exactly the point which I used. That it was used, both the two mayas and Anikantavada, in a particularly innovative fashion, which was soteric as well. So I think that it was to make it consistent.
Thank you.
That's where
the
differing came in.
No, well, I look forward to reading that. Please, please do send it to me.
Yeah.
Could you perhaps say a little more about something, this just shows my ignorance of the field, about the Jain Mimamsa debate you referred to?
I mean, this has been written up by Erle Kvarnström. I don't claim to be any authority on this. I mean, essentially it was around the question of authority and unimpeachable authority, either coming from the Veda or coming from... from the jinn, as was said earlier. I don't think I can say too much more about that. I mean, I forgot what it's in now, but I mean, you can read the longer version of this paper, probably in notes or somewhere. But it's in Studies in Jaina History and Culture, one edited by Peter Flugel in 2006. Well, just kind of Jain remarks for debate on this.
Any more questions or Shall we move to Gavin's final comments on the conference and thank Will very much.